Do you feel called to learn about science-faith integration and share what you learn with those around you? Join Reasons to Believe for an amazing trip to majestic Alaska from July 1st through 8th. If you'd like to hear more from and personally interact with Hugh Ross, Fuzz Rana, A.J. Roberts, Jeff Zwerink, and our special guest, Abdu Murray, from Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, head on over to inspirationcruises.com/RTB to reserve your stateroom. It's an 8-day cruise to Alaska from July 1st through 8th. The scholars will be sharing original content with you and the entire group. There will be opportunities to personally interact with the scholars and the entire staff. There'll be a sense of community to interact with like-minded individuals who all share a heart for science faith evangelism. Registration now open. Sign up now. Go to inspirationcruises.com/RTB.
This program is brought to you by the monthly partners of Reasons to Believe. For more information, please visit our website at reasons.org/monthly partner.
Welcome to Imago Dei, engaging minds created in the image of God. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. How does Christianity compare with the world's major religions? And what are they anyway? Well, Ken has a helpful chart in his book, God Among Sages. Ken, we've been covering various aspects of your book. We've been cruising right along, learning quite a bit. Dave, I know I have. I'm sure you have as well. And yes. Ken, you're going to cover that aspect of it, going through the various religions. You have a helpful chart. In fact, it's coming from page 230 of your book.
That's right. Yes. I thought that, we've done a couple shows here in a row looking at various aspects of the world's religions, talking a lot about Jesus. That, of course, is the central thrust of my new book. I thought maybe we could, in this show, kind of give from a B to Z. We'll start with Buddhism and end with Zoroastrianism. talk a little bit about these religions, maybe give some numbers to them, give people an indication of where most of these individuals live that adhere to these positions, and, what their religious leader says and their role. So, again, we'll be looking at a chart I have on page 230, if you've got my new book, and I hope you do.
Yes.
And I want to encourage some of our listeners who write reviews. It'd be really nice to get some of our people out and write a review on Amazon.com. A lot of people look at those reviews and evaluate them, and so I want to encourage some of our listeners to give consideration to that.
Please.
So, Joe, I'm going to call this show The Religions of the World in Jesus. And I want to begin by talking a little bit about the number of religious people in the world. If you've listened to the last couple programs, you know that the Pew Report said that by 2050, if trends continue as they are now, there'll be about 9 billion people in the world. 3 billion, they estimate, will be Christian. Just about 3 billion will be Muslims, and then there'll be another 3 billion, and that other 3 billion will be the rest of the religions of the world and secularism. Mm. And so that's going to be an intriguing time. I mean, even today, even right now, Christians and Muslims make up about 55% of the world's population. So as much as we talk about secularism with regard to RTB and its mission. And obviously, as a science faith organization, we're going to be looking at evolution. We're going to be looking at the worldview of naturalism. Dave and I, before the show, were talking a little bit about the new atheists and their challenge. So we spend a lot of time looking at Darwinism. We spend a lot of time looking at a worldview of secular naturalism. But we must remember that maybe secularism might make up 14% of the world's population. So that means 86% of the people in the world are religious in a traditional sense. Now, of course, in one sense, if you look at Romans 1, I think a fair reading of what Paul writes in Romans 1 is that everybody in their heart of hearts, and the word heart is a biblical word for the core of your being, where you form your most important beliefs. At the core of our being, at the heart of who we are, Paul seems clearly to indicate that people know there's a God. They not only know there's a God, they know they're morally accountable, and they seek to dodge that responsibility. So we've talked before about how are we to think about the world's religions. Well, God has revealed himself in nature, in conscience, in history. Later, he will reveal himself in Yahweh of the Old Testament, in Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And so people have a religious impulse, and I would argue even secularists, even atheists, I'm kind of psychoanalyzing them because I'm giving some revelation from Scripture that talks about the nature of a person's inner thought life, their core of their being, so to speak. But, you know, people are religious, and even atheists are religious. I think two great examples of atheism that had religious tendencies was atheistic existentialism in the middle of the 20th century, and communism. It had a very religious kind of impulse, the way it was oriented. But even if we take that 14% out, you've got 86% of the world are people who are part of some religious, some world religion, if you will. And, of course, we haven't said anything about basic religions and Native American, South American, African, Asian religions. There's plenty of religions out there that we have not focused on. We're looking at the major religions of the world. Let's then begin and talk about some of these particular religions. A good place is to talk about a religion that's probably the most recent world religion. For many years, for centuries, Islam was the youngest of the world's religion. But there's a religion called the Baha'i religion, spelled B-A-H-apostrophe-I, Baha'i. And Baha'i really comes out of Islam. It is a religion that has a prophet, and they believe that there are many prophets, Jesus, and before him, maybe Abraham or Moses, and then Muhammad would come. And then in the 19th century, a man appeared, a prophet named Baha'u'llah is his name. And it was his goal to be a prophetic leader where he would bring all the religions together as one. So in the 19th century, there's a lot of hostility among the religions, particularly in the Middle East. A lot of friction between Jews, Christians, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists in the Middle East and in various other places. And so his goal was to bring a oneness. And if you've ever been in a Baha'i center, I remember going to a yearly carnival they have here in Southern California. And I like to walk around the various booths, and I bumped into a Baha'i booth, and a guy came out and began talking to me and asked me if I'd ever encountered the Word. I remember that. Have you encountered the Word? And so I said, well, I think I have, but I'm not sure my word is your word.
Right.
So we had a lengthy discussion. But it's an emphasis upon oneness, an emphasis upon unity, upon peace. Baha'i tends to be very politically correct because all the religions can have a place at the table. There is not an emphasis upon exclusivism, although when they want to make it their oneness, they immediately become exclusivistic. There's no way of escaping exclusivistic claims. And so as much as they would prefer to be politically tolerant and respectful, they're going to say that Baha'u'llah trumps everybody else's particular prophets.
You know, I think I've seen some kind of freeway sign where this section sponsored by
yes.
Baha'i
sure.
faith. I forget what they're sponsoring, but roadside cleanup or
yep.
something like that, sponsored by the Baha'i, local Baha'i chapter
I
or something.
There's a, in Israel, up on this mountain overlooking the Megiddo the plains of, I've forgotten what, there's a Baha'i temple up there.
I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah.
7 million worldwide. They tend to be fairly affluent. There is a Baha'i temple here in Southern California. And a lot of times you might even mistake them for being Muslims in the sense of kind of wanting to bring their emphasis then would want to bring all of the monotheistic religions together, but all of them together under their prophet.
So there's one temple here, you said?
There is a temple here in Southern California, at least one temple here in Southern California. So that's the Baha'i religion, starting with the bees. Another bee religion that we've talked a little bit about, of course, is a very significant religion. It's the religion of Buddhism. Buddhism has been around approximately 500 years before the birth of Christ. It all depends on when you date the Buddha, and that fluctuates. One of the things I found interesting in writing my book was that scholars don't know what century the Buddha was born in. It could fluctuate by 250 to 300 years. Now think about that. In Christianity, we hotly debate whether Jesus was born in 6 or 4 BC, whether he died in 30 or 33. Here in Buddhism, they're wondering, we're not sure what century. Our traditional dates may be off. He may have been either born before or after. How many Buddhists do we have in the world? And here I'm looking at Wikipedia, have it before me, 376 million, about 5.2% of the world's population. Now, that's not very large. If you think that, you know, I'm looking here at the number for Hinduism, if I can find it here on my list somewhere, yes, here it is, 1 billion people. Christianity, 2.2 billion. Islam, 1.6 billion. Buddhism is a relatively small amount in terms of 376 million, but I would say that Buddhism is a very significant religion. I suggest that Buddhism is Christianity's greatest philosophical challenge. Now, that might surprise some people because Islam is a hugely populated religion, you know, 1.6 and you know, by the middle of this century, there'll be 3 billion. So why wouldn't you consider Islam to be the greatest competition? If you think about a free market competition, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody's kind of got their ideas, and we're kind of negotiating and debating. The reason I say that is this. A lot of secular people are attracted to Buddhism. And I think the reason is that Buddhism offers you a spirituality. It offers you a way of life that may not involve God at all. I mean, you could be a Mahayana Buddhist and worship God, but you could have an original form of Buddha, Theravada or Theravada Buddhism, have no belief in God at all. And I think that one of the reasons that I consider it a challenge is that Buddhism starts with the problem of pain and suffering. It is a philosophy of life that centers on that idea of why is there pain and suffering, and how do we address that issue. I'm not terribly impressed with the solutions that they offer to solve the riddle of pain and suffering, but nonetheless, I think it is a philosophy, a religious philosophy of life that cerebral people are interested in. And so, again, that's another one of the major religions. Interesting point I thought about Buddhism is that Siddhartha Gautama, the name Buddha is really a title, an awakened one. Just as Christ is a title.
It's not his last name.
It's not his last. I used to think when I meet Joseph and Mary, I'd say, how you doing, Mr. and Mrs. Christ? No, Jesus has a lot of titles. Right. Well, the Buddha has a title, the awakened one. He was asleep, and now he is awakened unto nirvana. Buddhism begins in India, but today there are very few Buddhists living in India. They've had a lot of competition with Hinduism and with Islam. And so Buddhism's influence has left India and has influenced places, especially like Southeast Asia, the continent of China. So you see there the Buddhist influence in the Asian part of the world.
Could you also say, Ken, that it gets a boost here in places like the West and, say, Hollywood, whereas Christianity gets a slam every time, but it gets an apparent boost in unexpected places?
Absolutely. I think just as when the Beatles were popular in the 60s and George Harrison became involved in Krishna consciousness, Hinduism got a boost. I think that there are many entertainers who like spirituality, but there's no moral God to tell you necessarily what to do. That doesn't mean, I'm not intending to convey that Buddhists don't have ethics, because they do. They have some pretty rigorous views about not killing and things of that nature. But there are entertainers. I'm thinking right now of Mick Jagger, the lead singer, one of the founders of the rock and roll group, the Rolling Stones. He claims to be a Buddhist, a student of religion. And I think part of it is that sometimes in Hollywood you get to pick and choose. Hinduism and Buddhism may be viewed favorably if you are affluent living in the West, but if you live in Asia or other parts of the world and see some of the tremendous detriment in terms of poverty and things like that, Buddhism and Hinduism would not rank nearly as high. So again, part of the issue is that I think people kind of look at religion as if you'd walk into an ice cream store and say, well, I'll take a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But we know the problem. We've dealt with it a couple shows ago. The problem is when you start saying, well, why can't I have all these religions? The problem is that they contradict each other. They conflict with each other. And it's not going to help us to do that. I think if we want to get to the bottom of these religions, we have to look at them carefully and listen to them in their own terms. What do they say? Today, I had a debate earlier in the morning with a Hindu scholar. And there were a number of things that he said that I disagreed with. But I was also trying to listen very carefully, because I felt I was being benefited by actually talking, interacting with somebody who actually held this religious perspective. And so part of me did want, as an apologist, my instinct is to rebut and to show where I thought his thinking was undermined. But on the other hand, I also wanted to hear him out. I wanted to hear the way he thought about things. And I think it's awfully important, to understand people. Point I've made many times, I think it's difficult to understand views and beliefs that you don't agree with. I think it's easy to talk past each other. I think that happens in politics. I think it happens in religion. Protestants and Catholics often don't understand each other, and they're very closely connected into history. Imagine trying to understand somebody who believes in Baha'ism or Buddhism.
Half the time, I don't understand what you're talking
Half
about.
Half the time, you and I can't even agree. So I think you have to kind of take a look inside this, and Buddhism is a very foundational religion. Now, it's important for me to say that Buddhism is not a standalone religion. Buddhism emerged from Hinduism. If you look at my book, God Among Sages, you'll notice that when I look at the four religious leaders, I start with Krishna, move to Buddha, because Hinduism birthed Buddhism. And the Buddha came out of Hinduism and in many ways rejected that religion, rejected the reincarnation, the eternal soul, rejected the caste system. So Buddhism is an offshoot of Hinduism, and that's why the Buddha was born in India, even though today very few Buddhists in India.
What puzzles me is why there are Western secularists, scientists. I remember Carl Sagan expressing an interest in Buddhism,
yeah,
that somehow it was attractive to him.
Yeah, my instinct, Dave, is to say that even people like Sagan, very secular man in most respects, that they're still looking for some kind of spirituality, that I can be spiritual without being religious. Mm. I can have a spiritual philosophy rather than a formal religion, if you will. And I think that's part of that appeal. You know, I think probably another part is that there is kind of the paradoxes of life, Zen Buddhism and things of that nature. And we all know that there are benefits from meditation. There are benefits from some kind of spiritual life, calming your heart, your blood pressure, better health, things of that nature. You know, and that's kind of part of that Western element that I'm going to benefit from some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've looked at Baha'i and Buddhism. Let's move to a C religion. I'm going to skip Christianity. You might ask, do I view Christianity as a religion? I do. And I think it's even mentioned in James that, you know, there's true religion
right.
as opposed to false religion. But we talk a lot about Christianity. And, of course, we're talking about Christianity in comparison. Let's talk about Confucianism. I might say, as we've said before, Buddha was the enlightened one. He's going to lead people to nirvana. He's not a savior. There's no salvation in Buddhism. So the Buddha is really another individual pointing the way to nirvana, to eliminating or eluding the suffering that happens in the world. Confucianism, I think, is a fascinating religion, and I think that it is important for a number of things, for a number of reasons. One is that many people debate whether Confucianism should even be considered a religion. It is deeply focused on the idea of ethics. And so Confucianism says very little about the question of God, of the afterlife. And, you know, so you have this religion where Confucius is living approximately 500 years before the birth of Christ. China is going through cultural warfare. He wants to develop a philosophy of life that will allow his culture rather than to go down the moral, you know, hole of war, to actually thrive. And so he starts to develop moral principles that the people of China can follow. And it's interesting, even though I say that, because I have to mention there are some people who've done research that have led them to conclude that even with the focus, the heavy focus on morality and cultural practices within Confucianism, that he may have been a theist. He may actually have believed in a single personal God.
This is Confucius.
This is Confucius. So there are these debates that go on within the Confucian religion about how those kinds of things are to be understood. He's an ethical leader. His goal is to build a moral society. If you think of Confucianism, it could be small in numbers, but a point that I often point out about Confucianism is that people in other Asian religions follow Confucius. For example, there's kind of a consensus in the Asian world that when it comes to life and death, ultimate issues, I follow the Buddhist interpretation. But when it comes to my spirituality, I'm a Taoist, right? Spelled with a T, pronounced with a D, a Taoist, D-A-O-T-A-O-I-S-M. But when it comes to my ethics, I follow Confucianism. And so in one sense, Confucian numbers may be relatively small, but if all virtually all Asian peoples of the world are taught kind of a Confucian ethic, he's a big name. He has a big influence. And so when you think of the four individuals that I compare Jesus with in God Among Sages, you think of Krishna and the influence of a billion Hindus in the world. By the way, the Hindu I debated this morning on the Justin Brierley show, You can go on Justin Brierley's unbelievable program and go back and look at the various debates that he has. He said that he believed in one God and that Hindus believe in one God. And so most of my friends who study world religions, and I put myself in the category as well, I always believed that most Hindus were pantheists. But the reality is that most Hindus are bhakti Hindus. They believe in one God, and that one God is Krishna. So again, you have that kind of blending. So Confucianism is much more of a moral philosophy, not heavy on dogma or doctrine, but very strong on ethical principles. And the point I was making there, as I got a little off on Krishna, think about Krishna, you think about Buddha, Confucius, and Muhammad. You're talking about some individuals that have had some big influence on the number of people living in the world.
Right.
These are people, there are four individuals that are long dead, but they still have an abiding influence
in the world we live. Would somebody living in an Asian country, regardless of what country that would they be exposed to Confucianism, and would they be encouraged to abide by Confucian principles, even though they may be of another religion, just because the ethical principles are
that's right
are good?
Yeah,
solid?
Yeah. Let's say
so. It's eclectic then.
Very much so. So you're living in Southeast Asia. Hey, I kind of like the Buddhist view of nirvana, the Buddhist interpretation of reincarnation, but I like the Taoist spirituality. But when it comes to ethics, I follow the path of Confucianism. Now, that's a little bit easier, Joe, because those three religions don't make a lot of metaphysical claims. They make some, but it's not nearly like me claiming, for example, to be a Jew, a Christian, and a Muslim. Well, those issues almost immediately clash, particularly over this person named Jesus. But yeah, you have that. You have that mixing. You have kind of what they call a consensus in that part of the world. And so somebody who is not necessarily a Confucianist in the full Chinese context may still know a lot about him and know certain principles of his ethics.
You know, it just makes me wonder, I guess, a reaction from both of you, that it seems like it makes the Christian missionaries' task formidable when you come in with truth claims. If people are living in such a way that they're just kind of choosing a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and we've talked about pluralism so much in the previous three and now fourth podcast, that it seems like your task is a difficult one if you're coming in with truth claims.
And if you consider, Joe, how things have changed, I mean, we did a little advertisement for my book, and as part of that ad, I made the point that, you know, 50, 100 years ago, if you wanted to talk with a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Confucianist or a Muslim, you've got to go overseas. You would have to go on a mission trip. Today, just in your own neighborhood.
Right.
The school your kids go to, maybe the park that your kids have a soccer connection to. I mean, so that challenge of missionaries, by the way, missionaries used to, not saying they don't retain it, but missionaries had to be very sophisticated people. They had to have a sophisticated understanding of Christianity, had to be able to go to another culture, learn the language of the culture, learn cultural principles, and then tackle this question of how do I present Christianity in an appropriate cultural context. Americans are a little on the lazy side. Mm. So we get kind of, we go to a Dodger game. We go to a Laker game. I'm speaking Los Angeles here because Los Angeles is one of the most diverse ethnic, religious cities in the world. It's a lot like London, some of the other cities, where you have interaction with lots of religious philosophies of life. And again, one of the very practical reasons I wrote my book was to say, look, if you're a Christian and you have a real sense of wanting to do your part in reaching the lost for Christ and fulfilling the Great Commission. Is there a book? Is there a tool chest where you can sit down? And at the end of these four chapters on Krishna, Buddha, Confucius, and Muhammad, I look at the religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and Islam, and I talk about, here's some common ground. Then here are the differences. How can I begin to venture out and talk about some of these kinds of things?
Right. Yeah, you do a good job of that in those chapters.
Well, the next religion is of course one we've talked about, Hinduism, Krishna being the central figure. He's an avatar. Avatars are different than the incarnation. Avatars happen many times. The incarnation happens once. The incarnation happened in history. The appearances of Krishna or others in the world ascending into the world may be mythological. Avatars can appear as humans or as animals. So there's a difference between an avatar and the Christian doctrine of the incarnation. But Krishna is the most important person, religious person within Hinduism. How many Hindus do we have again? We have a billion. A billion people. Now, one of the things that the Hindu scholar said today in my debate dialogue, Justin Brierley, if you've never heard Justin Brierley, you have heard him because he does some of the voiceover for our podcast.
That's right. Introduces and closes the podcast, yeah.
He has a interesting apologetic program. He told me today most of the time they spend debating between Christians and atheists. So he said, I'm happy to have a Christian and a Hindu on the program to talk. But, you know, we were talking about these kinds of things. And, you know, he mentioned the Hindu scholar mentioned to me that not only did he only believe in one God, but that he also believed that that all the religions of the world were true. And he believed, for example, that Jesus was one of those particular prophets. So, again, this idea, at Biola University, I teach a course every other year for them, I think, maybe every 2 years. They have a comparative religion class. And Craig Hazen, who wrote a nice endorsement for my book, he has me teach a comparative religion, and the writing assignment, Joe, for the class is you have to go out and interview a clergyman, a scholar, a professor who holds a different religious worldview than you do. So you got to go talk to a Hindu priest or a Muslim imam or a Buddhist priest. And I have never in the 27 years now of teaching, this is what students come back to me and say, I've never had a project like this that has been so meaningful to me. Dave and Joe, it's one thing to sit around as an armchair philosopher, as an armchair evangelist, as an armchair theologian, and talk about people who hold other religions. It's another thing to sit down, look into the eyes of the rabbi and mm-hmm. say, what do you think about Jesus?
Mm-hmm.
Rabbis make some of the best interviews because, well, they're biblically trained, they're Western, they know a lot about Christianity, they usually have very strong opinions. But the students come back to me and say, wow, this has kind of changed my thinking about evangelism and apologetics. And I want to be able to put a book in their hand and say, look, everybody's nervous about talking to a person who is in another religion. Some of us feel nervous when people knock on our door and want to tell us about the gospel of the Watchtower or the gospel of the Latter-day Saints. You know, we're not quite sure what to do. But if you can prepare yourself, you do a little study, you can actually talk to these people. And the students not only do it, and the vast majority of them get really good scores on their papers, but they really thrive at it. They think, boy, this was one of the most significant features of taking an apologetics degree. So yeah. part of what I did in my book is modeled in some of the courses I've taught. Hinduism, of course, is a major religion, billion people. I think one of the things I wanted to say earlier was that the Hindu scholar said that Hinduism is not a proselytizing religion. Yeah, Justin said, well, you mean you don't want to proselytize Ken? You just want to let Ken believe whatever he wants? He goes, well, yeah, that's okay. And he said, what do you think, Ken? No, I want to proselytize. And that's part of the difference between Christianity and Hinduism. Hinduism grows largely by the population of India. But in the 1960s and 70s, Krishna consciousness was pretty much an evangelistic type of faith. All you have to remember is going to Los Angeles International Airport in the 60s and 70s, and members of Krishna consciousness would be there wanting you to buy their literature, mm-hmm. wanting you to hear about them. So even though Hinduism is not a proselytizing religion, that doesn't mean that all aspects of the religion are not kind of pushing their point of view.
I understand it's also true that you can be a Christian and be a Hindu in the Hindu faith. In other words, they don't have any issues with someone who includes, as long as you don't get baptized or...
Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah, the Hindu scholar today said that there are all these spiritual paths.
Right.
Ken's getting there through Christianity. I'm getting there through Krishna. You can be in the other religions, and as long as your Jesus views don't conflict with their fundamental Hindu views, and by the way, they do conflict.
Right.
I think a lot of Hindus today, particularly people who may live in London, who have kind of a postmodern, inclusivistic, pluralistic idea, I think in many respects, you know, they think all the religions are fine. And that's kind of part of that mm-hmm. New Age-ish idea that right. we see in the West. We've talked about Baha'i, Buddhism, Confucianism, Hinduism, Islam, a religion we've talked a lot about, maybe 1.6 billion Muslims on the way to 3 billion, according to the Pew Report, by 2050. Muhammad, the prophet. The final prophet, there are all of these other prophets who came before him. Many of them are biblical prophets, including Jesus. And what was Muhammad's message? That there is one God, not many gods. There's one God. His name is Allah. There's going to be a judgment, and you need to submit yourself to God. If you want to fare well in that judgment, you need to subjugate yourself to God. Well, Islam is, even with all of the black eyes that radical terrorism that is reflected in the Islamic religion conveys, it's still a rapidly growing religion. Why? Probably population numbers primarily. So a very significant religion. Another religion I'll bet few people have heard of is called Jainism, J-A-I-N-I-S-M, Jainism. Central leader is Mahavira. This is a religion that also comes out of Hinduism. So Hinduism has been the mother of a number of religions. This religion is very popular in the Asian part of the world, the Indian part of the world. They teach strong asceticism. They believe in reincarnation, have similar views to parts of the Hindu religion. And many people will look at the Jains and think that they may be Hindus. Looking at the numbers here for Jainism, for the Wikipedia is 4.2 million. 4.2 million. So Hinduism has birthed Buddhism. It's birthed Jainism. It will later birth another religion called Sikhism, a religion that we haven't talked a lot about, Judaism. Judaism is a tiny religion. The numbers are very small. Here from the Wikipedia, 14 million worldwide. 14 million worldwide. Hmm. Christianity, 2.2 billion. Islam, 1.6 billion.
So its influence far outweighs its numbers.
Absolutely. I would say in a talk that I give, where I talk about the five most influential religions, I mention Judaism. I list it not because of numbers, but because of influence, the incredible influence not only on Christianity, but on Western culture. I mean, Dave, how many scientists have Jewish backgrounds?
Boy.
How many?
A lot.
How many Jewish?
And Nobel laureates.
Yeah, how many Jewish doctors, attorneys?
Musicians.
Musicians.
One of the greatest musicians.
I mean, anytime you you look at the most successful religious group here in America in terms of finances, Jews are right at the top of the list. If you look at religions with the greatest advanced education, Jews right at the top of the list. An incredibly influential religion in the world. You think back to the 20th century, the beginning of World War II, there were approximately 9 million Jews in Europe. After the Holocaust, there were less than 3 million. 6 million Jews were killed in Hitler's Holocaust. And yet, out of that great time of terror, out of that great time of suffering, hard to imagine that a country would have a systematic program to exterminate an entire race of people. Out of that comes a nation for Israel. And now a nation that in many ways thrives in the Middle East, a democratic nation. Judaism is one of those remarkable religions. Of course, the central prophet, we think in terms of Judaism, we think of Moses, but we could think of Abraham before that. We think of the Hebrew Bible. We think that, here's one for you, the Savior of the world was a Jew. Our Lord and Savior is the Jewish Messiah. And so the deep connections between Christianity and Judaism are very, very profound. I had one lady say to me, I wrote a book, Seven Truths That Changed the World. She said, Ken, most of those truths are Jewish truths. And I said, well, you're partly true. Christianity builds upon Jewish ideas. Creation ex nihilo, this incredible idea affirmed by Christians, is also taught in the Old Testament. So Judaism, amazing religion. Another religion called Shinto, Shinto, S-H-I-N-T-O-ism, Shintoism, from the country of Japan. Very untraditional religion. They have a mythology of gods, the gods who created the world. It is in many ways a kind of a nature-oriented religion, a strong emphasis upon peace and cultural building. They have their gods called the Kami gods.
K-A-M-I.
K-A-M-I. Very, very in many ways polytheistic, but also untraditional. They don't have a lot to say about the afterlife and the metaphysical world, but we have one of our friends who works closely with RTB, who is a missionary to Japan, and he can talk with you about the religion of Shintoism. Let's see if I've got...
Did you mention what the mission was for Judaism?
Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't. Of course, Moses as the prophet communicates the will and the law of Yahweh, and so the two greatest events in the Old Testament would be the Exodus and the giving of the law. So this is that command that Moses would carry out. And of course, Jesus sees himself as the new Moses. Jesus is the fulfillment of that law that's given to the Jews. Let's see, Shintoism, 4 million. 4 million.
4 million, okay.
Japan tends to be a fairly secular-based country. As we're moving along, keeping my eye there on that clock, don't like to make these programs excessively long, We have another S religion. It's Sikhism, S-I-K-H-I-S-M, Sikhism. This religion is really a religion that tries to bring some comparison between Hindu and Islamic ideas, so another religion influenced by Hinduism. The follower is a man named Nanak. He is known as the prophet. It tends to be rather mystical in its idea of its union with God. Sikhism is not terribly large. I'm not sure I have... yes, I do. It's actually larger than I thought, 23 million. Hmm. 23 million. We're down to the T. Taoism, pronounced with the D, spelled with a T. I hope I said that earlier correctly. Taoism. Taoism is another religion that is Asian in orientation. There is a story, it may very well be a mythical story, that the great sage Tao, Lao Tzu, that he met Confucius and that they had an interaction and talked about their different philosophies of life. That may not have happened at all, but it is a great story. Lao Tzu is seen as one of the major religious leaders. And again, it's hard to kind of put your finger on the belief of the Tao. It is very nature-oriented, that there is this mystical way that you are to follow, but in terms of gods or doctrines, very limited in that orientation.
Is it the yin and yang?
They do have the yin yang.
Okay.
That is practiced by a number of people who live in China, but comes out of the Tao, these opposite mm-hmm. ideas, the idea of the various opposites of life. And that brings us all the way down. We started with B, with Baha'i and Buddhism, and we reach a religion that I find very fascinating. It comes out of the Middle East. It was the most influential religion in Persia, in Iran, before the coming of Islam. It's called Zoroastrianism. The prophet Zoroaster believed in one god. They worship a god named Ahura Mazda. Joe, here in Orange County, they have a temple where you can actually visit with them and talk with them about their belief in one god. You can go on, I believe, Zoroastrianism.com, also known as the Parsi faith. This is kind of an original Middle Eastern monotheism before the coming of Islam, going back into the ancient world. There are reports that when Muhammad was in his caravan in the desert, in the Arabian desert, he bumped into not only Christians and Jews, but also members of the Parsi or Zoroastrian faith. So a strict monotheism, a strict morality that is connected to these religions. Now, what do I say about all of this?
I have a question before you
sure.
summarize Islam and perhaps some of these others. But I'm thinking of Islam in particular. Is there salvation in Islam?
Technically, the answer is no. There, it is not a salvific religion.
I mean, if I'm a murderer, for instance, and I become a Muslim, am I forgiven, or is there salvation? Or
well, that's a good question. Muslims do talk about sin. They do talk about forgiveness. But technically, Dave, if you use a term we're very familiar with, a very important biblical word of redemption, mm-hmm. where there is a sacrifice for your sin, seen in the Old Testament and mm-hmm. the various sacrificial system, Jesus, his death on the cross is a sacrifice, the answer is no. Now, could a murderer change his ways? Could he submit his life to Allah? Could he begin to practice the five pillars, praying five times a day, confessing the Shahada, the creed, there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet, giving part of his tithes, fasting during Ramadan, making the pilgrimage to Mecca, conforming his life, submission, very important word in Islam, mm-hmm. he might do okay, at least potentially. He might do okay in the judgment. And there are Muslims who have changed their ways, so to speak.
So all the good things that I'm doing, whatever they, all these you listed, they're weighed against the bad things that I've done.
Yes.
And it's conceivable that they could outweigh
theoretically,
a life where I've murdered and...
Theoretically, yes. And some people ask me, why is Islam? Remember, I was at a church in Fresno, and a person asked me, why is Islam? I think I mentioned that even with radical terrorism, Islam continues to grow at a rapid rate. They asked me why. One person said, because it's satanic. I said, well, there are counterfeits, spiritual counterfeits that are in various religions. And when you study the world's religions, you need to recognize that these are not neutral belief systems.
Mm-hmm.
I said, however, another element that you may want to consider in this idea of why Islam is so popular is it is the natural religion of man. Do your best.
Yeah.
God is going, it's about you, Dave. You make the decision. You do it. Paradise is an earned reward. Damnation is what you deserve. Nobody can do it for you. The Prophet Muhammad can point the way, but you have to make the effort. Mm-hmm. There's no G, no grace. And I get very uncomfortable when people start talking about how spiritual I'm supposed to be, but don't give me the G word. Give me the G mm-hmm. word. Tell me that I'm saved by grace. And so I think Islam is popular because it's the natural religion. That's the way the person thinks. Good people go to heaven, bad people go to hell. I'm not as good as Mother Teresa, not as bad as, you know, one of the bad people.
Stalin, Hitler,
Mussolini. And so you get your fluctuation. Whereas the Bible says that we're all wretches, that all of us have sinned against God. I remember reading the Confessions, and Augustine said, "What sins have I not committed, and even those that I haven't considered?" Being a fallen sinner, being someone who has violated the law of God, I can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. I can't model a life where I can earn the merit and favor of God. It has to be the righteousness of Christ that is given to me. And therefore, the teaching element, the gospel element, again, why I say that when it comes to Christianity, the set of beliefs, a collection of values, a way of life, but the beliefs are the most important. The way of life follows from that belief that Christ has died for me, has changed my status before God, begins to change the kind of character that I have. Now, how Joe and Dave, do we sum up these religions? I would just say a couple brief things. I would say that we live in a religious world, and we shouldn't be surprised by the fact that people are religious. The Bible tells us they're going to be religious. The Bible tells us they know certain things about God, they get certain things right. But because of our fallenness, because of satanic counterfeits, they're going to have maybe some moral principles, but there'll be false Christs, false prophets, false gospels. And so we should expect that kind of thing. But a great way to consider evangelism is talking about Jesus Christ. Who is he? What did he do? What makes him different? And why are you putting all of your trust in him instead of Krishna or Buddha or Confucius or Muhammad? I think that's a great way of kind of talking about your faith. Who is Jesus and what makes him different than everybody else? So, you know, you and I don't compare very well with Jesus, and neither do the great sages of the world.
Excellent. All right, Ken, well, thank you for that wrap-up. That was a great way to close out your book. We certainly hope you will get a copy. Ken, you've been busy doing all kinds of interviews.
Yes.
How's that been going for you? You want to say anything? Any good stories?
It's been great. I did two programs with a pastor who is a missionary from Iran, and we did one program in English and another one in Farsi. And that was an amazing thing to see it projected all throughout the Middle East. I've done a number of television and radio interviews, did this debate and dialogue today. So it's exciting. Writing, Joe, as you know, is very hard work, but it's kind of, I think the payoff is when the book is out, you think it's of good quality and it can help some people. So I'm excited to have opportunities. I want to encourage people to buy two.
Two. Get your
one
copies.
For yourself,
yes.
One to hand to your neighbor. Mm-hmm. And then maybe write a review of it on Amazon. That helps people know, hey, this is a book I might want to consider reading.
Yeah. Ultimately, of course, we want you to be able to share this, as we've been saying, with others. As you know, RTB is an apologetics-oriented ministry, and we have that goal in mind, that people will come to faith in Christ. So be sure and get a couple of copies. All right, that's going to wrap it up for this podcast. Thanks for listening. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening. Join us for the next edition of Imago Dei.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.